What does it mean to bring our whole selves into the world? To give ourselves the gift of unconditional acceptance? Join me as we learn together. I'm Jorgen Salvis, and this is Unshaming. This week, I interviewed Quan Huynh. He's the author of the book Sparrow in the Razor Wire. For much of his adolescence, he was involved in crime, gangs, and violence, spending much of his early 20s in and out of jail. And in 1999, he was charged with the death penalty for murdering another man in gang-related violence. He was found guilty of second-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison with an opportunity for parole. In 2015, he was released from prison on parole after being determined suitable by his parole board. Now, how does someone go from murdering someone to becoming suitable to reenter society? Quan's transformation story is what made him so compelling to me. He now works for Defy Ventures, a nonprofit helping those with a criminal past transform their lives through entrepreneurship. His book touches on so many different ideas, but one of the more poignant topics is the importance of grieving. At age 13, Quan lost his father to cancer. He didn't end up grieving that loss until he was well into his prison sentence, 25 years later. In his own words, the grief never went away. Instead, it was channeled through violence. The book really got me thinking about all of the different forms of grief that are out there, and furthermore, all the different forms of grief that never really get dealt with. Not just death, but breakups, the loss of partners, the loss of friendships, the loss of jobs, even the loss of our former selves. I've been realizing that unless we deal with grief and confront it, it never really goes away. It was Timothy Shriver who said, "When you get grief wrong, you get a lot of things wrong in life." The book also talks about what it means to own our stories. Quan talks candidly about what it means to own the objective truth that he murdered someone, and the shame of this identity. And part of his journey to feel worthy of life was realizing that he needed to lean into that shame. It's a lesson that's honestly applicable to all of us, because shame is a universal experience. It's something that every one of us feels at some point in our life. And what I learned from this interview with Quan is that the deepest sense of power does not come from stoicism. It comes from vulnerability, being fearless about showing our most authentic selves to the world around us. For the actual interview, I asked Quan to start at the very beginning of his story because I want you to feel really immersed in his universe. I want you to have all the context you need to really understand who he is and what his story is all about. So before we dive into this interview, I do want to read you an excerpt of the book, a small excerpt that explains the title really beautifully. And for context, this is the moment that Quan has this major epiphany, 12 years into his prison sentence on the prison yard, that prison does not have to be a punishment. Up above me in the razor wire, I heard the chirp of a sparrow. I looked up and there it was, perched between the circular coils of the shiny razor wire. It was dark brown with uneven white streaks. I noticed it was missing the lower part of one leg, and on the other had three claws instead of four. It was obvious it had lost the claw and limb from landing on the razor wire, yet with all of the scarring and deformities, the sparrow still perched proud, singing for whoever was listening. I looked up at the razor wire again, and a second sparrow had landed near the first one. This one was also scarred, with a lump where one of his claws used to be. They were both singing, all these years, They'd been singing, and I hadn't been listening, I thought to myself. I looked at the men nearby, and nobody seemed to notice anything. None of us had been listening. This is the shame of murder.
I came to the United States as a toddler. I wasn't even 1 year old yet. We settled in Provo, Utah. I have two younger siblings. My brother and sister were both born there in Provo. We were the only Vietnamese family in the city. And we were also Roman Catholic. The vast majority of people that lived in Utah were Mormon, and they were white. For the most part, I would say I loved growing up over there. I loved being around just my childhood over there. But I did experience what I do now know to be racism while I grew up over there also. Quite a few instances that happened. And the one that sticks most in my mind was one when my younger brother and I were just playing with our G.I. Joes in the streams, and some older kids told us, and then it was some adults too, they told us to go back to our country. We told them to make us because we were little kids, and they chased us down. I dropped some of my G.I. Joes. I was about 8. My younger brother was probably 6. My brother turned around to pick up our G.I. Joes and to fight the kids, and they shoved him to the ground, punched him, and began to shove dirt in his mouth. And I sat there and I didn't do anything. Of course, we walk home. We were both crying when my father found out. I remember him telling me, how could you let this happen to your younger brother? How could you not protect your family? So I felt very ashamed when that happened. Yeah, and you know, what made it worse is my father never talked about it again, which I'm sure because he never thought about it again. But in my mind at the time, I felt and I thought that I had let my family down.
I know you said in the book he passed away when you were 13 years old, right? So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that too.
My father was a social activist back then, and he basically created the Vietnamese Refugee Association, and it was to help other Vietnamese families adjust to their new homelands. So I remember as a little boy, I got to travel with my father to neighboring states like Wyoming or Arizona, Colorado, just to help other families that were Vietnamese. He helped them with filling out their social security for driver's license, you know, government documents, things like that. My father helped these families. He worked full time at the nearby coal mines in Price, but this is something that he did on the side to help out these families. And I remember as a little boy, I asked him, like, how much do you get paid for this job? And he told me he didn't get paid. And it didn't make any sense to me. Like, why would you do something and not get paid for it? You know, and at that time, I didn't really understand what lesson he was trying to teach me. I just thought he's supposed to get paid. Around when I was 8 years old, my father was taken to the hospital and they said he had leukemia. And that's when we first found out, like, what cancer is, in particular, what leukemia is. You know, of course, as a little boy, I thought, my father is invincible. Yeah, he goes in and out of the hospital, but he's invincible. By the time we were 10, my father's condition started getting worse, and we moved out to California because his family lived out there. So that was my first time going to school with kids that were from different races, you know, that were Hispanic, and there were Blacks, and there were Asians, and there were other Vietnamese kids. We were Catholic. So I remember my mom telling us leading up to our first communion that our father was going to die. And I was in denial about it. And I just told myself, you know what? I'm going to pray the first time I go to my first communion in our faith. I thought, like, I'm getting a piece of bread. I get to eat it, and I can make a prayer. My prayer is going to be that my dad is going to live, that he's not going to die. So in a way, I get to save my dad. The morning of my first communion, I woke up and my little sister tells me that my father had died the night before. In my mind at that time, I remember thinking that God had somehow killed my father just so he wouldn't have to grant my prayer because somehow I was a bad kid in some way. And, you know, even after my father passed away, our family, we didn't talk about it. We didn't talk about, you know, how are you feeling, or we didn't get to process or grieve his death you know, my mom never talked about it again. Me, my brother and sister never talked about it. We just went about living, but we're mourning, but not totally able to even, you know, process his death.
I think so many families share that sense of emotional silence. We don't really allow ourselves to grieve. Why is it that you think your mother and your family members never discussed that loss with you?
Partly the pain. Like I see even to this day, you know, what is it now? Like 30 years later, and my mom still doesn't really talk much about his death, or if she references it, I just see her eyes might tear up and then she'll just push back the feelings. Like maybe somehow that it's wrong to cry, or that it's, especially now, like, oh, now it's, this is 30 years later, like you would still cry over the loss of somebody. Like, I'm not sure. Like during that time, they didn't talk about it. I think it's maybe because it's just been in our family, like we don't talk about that, and we don't talk about our feelings, or we don't talk, we, you know, there's not much emotional literacy, so there's nothing there. They just hide it. I remember like some of my uncles and some of my father's friends that came to the funeral said that I was brave and I was a strong boy like my father because I wasn't crying. And everything in me wanted to cry and scream, but I thought this is how I have to be because this is what a strong person does. And this is, I want to be like my father. And if this is what my father would have done, then this is what I have to do. And I just shoved it into a corner and didn't talk about it. I remember even in junior high when my father passed away and I went back to school, I saw even other little kids. I think they found out my father died and they just whisper and look at me. And it made me further reinforced, like, crap, something's wrong. Kids just, they just didn't know. So they don't know what to say. And I just felt even more lonely at that time. And then right after that, I'm entering into high school. I was tiny at the time too. I think my freshman year, I only weighed like 88 pounds. And I wasn't even 5 feet yet. I was so tiny back then. So I think that made me stick out too. So I think just all those things compounded and I just never felt like I fit in.
Walk us through the process of what happened from that moment that you entered high school and your father passed away up until your first encounter with the police and being arrested.
You know, of course, being in high school and wanting to be liked and wanting to be popular or wanting to be, you know, at least accepted, you know, I had my friends that I hung out with, and some of them had older brothers that just seemed really cool. They had cars and they drove us around to places, but some of their older brothers were already involved in, you know, breaking into cars, stealing car stereos. I remember the first time I went with them one night and we broke into a car, and then I was going through the glove compartment and like there's this excitement, this fear. I had found a wallet and there were credit cards in it, and the older brothers told, oh yeah, good job, this is what we do. And they took us out to eat, and there were older women there, I mean, pretty girls, I thought, and suddenly were recognized, and I was recognized by them. So it just became part of my indoctrination into running on the streets. You know, by the time I'm a senior in high school, one of my friends, he had a small 22 caliber handgun that he got off the streets. During my senior year, some skinheads had called my house. There were some skinhead kids that we were having problems with in the neighborhood. We got in a fight with them at a beach over the summer, and then there was always this constant tension going back and forth. That's they went to a local continuation school, and we looked for them, and I heard that they were looking for me and my group of friends everywhere. They called my house, and they threatened to kill my mom and my sister. I was working at Subway's at the time. My younger brother came, and he told me that those skinheads had called the house, threatened to kill my family. So we sat there, and of course, you know, we have a gun. None of us had ever shot it. And we sat there and just discussed, okay, well, I get off work tonight at 10. Why don't you guys pick me up and we'll go find his house and we'll shoot him up. Those were our exact words. I asked my coworker who knew one of the skinheads, and she drew a map of where they lived and gave it to me. So I gave it to my brother and my friends. They said they would come back at 10 o'clock that night to pick me up. I got off at 10 o'clock. They didn't pick me up. I went home, and my brother was at home already. He was laying in bed. I think at the time he was 15. He was terrified. He said, well, after they left, they went to a local arcade, and they found another kid that knew where the skinheads lived. So he took them to the house. My friend ended up going up to the house, knocking on a door. When they opened it, he ran inside and shot three people in there. Fortunately, they all survived. And within a couple of weeks, we were all arrested for the first time for conspiracy to commit murder. And I went into juvenile hall.
Is that sort of when the interest in violence, is that when it began to start?
Yeah, I would say that is where, well, I mean, I was already interested in violence, but I think that's where it was reinforced in me. Like, this is how, you know, I was terrified going into juvenile hall at the time. I think when I weighed in, I mean, I was already tiny as a freshman. In my senior year, I was involved in wrestling. So I was supposed to get down to wrestle at 103 pounds. So I was always losing weight. So when I went into juvenile hall, I remember I weighed in at 106 pounds. So skinny, like my arms was all one, you know, you see my wrist and that's my upper arms was the same way. I was just all skin and bones. And I went into juvenile hall. And I learned really quick though that as long as you victimized others, that I would not be victimized. And then I getting into fights or volunteering to inflict violence on others, that's where I started to gain recognition. And I think it was for me, it became a place where, okay, as long as people recognize me as somebody that is considered, you know, in street language, somebody's down, then they're not going to get picked on. And that's the last thing I wanted was to get picked on.
Quan, I'm wondering if you can walk us through the night of the murder. What happened? What inspired it?
So after my first arrest, I came out of juvenile hall and the California Youth Authority, I think even more angry, with no knowledge that I knew I was, I mean, I had no clue that I was angry. I thought an angry person was somebody that screams and yells and makes a scene, never knowing that, okay, someone could also be angry by not showing it, shoving it into a dark corner and just taking it out on somebody for nothing. That's where my gang ties began, was in juvenile hall. And I came out to the streets and was arrested two more times after that for parole violations, gun and gang violations, and then paroled in 1998. I was working at the Gallup organization. This is like before the fame of their Strength Finder studies and all that. And I became their 1998 interviewer of the year. They asked me to interview for a management position. For me at that moment, it just felt like, you know what, this is for once in my life, something's going to go right. I've been given a raw deal my whole life. You know, my father died. I should have never been arrested the first time because I wasn't there. Like all these excuses I made up for myself of why my life was terrible, but now why this opportunity was going to finally fix whatever was wrong with my life. And I would be happy for once. And there wouldn't be this bitter resentment hanging over me. And they came back after the interview about a month or two, and they called me in the office and they said, Quan, we're sorry, but you are not a fit for the management position. That's the exact words they use. I mean, that is just how they say it. Like, you are not a fit. But for me, hearing that word, you are not a fit, I think just touched on a core part of me, feeling like I never fit in. I'm worthless. You know, I don't fit into this world or into this society. I didn't talk about it to anybody. I didn't share it with my girlfriend. I didn't talk to my mom about it. I did what I knew best, is I just went down to the local bar, got drunk. Within a week and a half, I had called up some of my homeboys from the same gang that I was part of. We decided to go up to a club up in Los Angeles. I brought my gun along. When I came out of the club that night, I found out that some of my friends had gotten in a fight with a group, another gang. Security had broken us all up, and I saw them across the street, so I orchestrated the people in my car to follow them. And, you know, parole board members at my hearing asked me, like, why did you have to be the trigger man? Like, you weren't even involved in the fight. Why would you do this? And I think for years, I thought, oh, well, this is something that I had to do. You know, like it was my life or theirs. But that was, for me now, like my understanding is I did it because, you know, there's all these feelings going on inside of me, all these feelings of failure, this anger, this resentment at the world, at myself, at God. And here was an opportunity for me to take it out on somebody. and in a weird sense, gain more recognition and you know, regain some sense of power in my life because I felt so out of control. So I followed them for about 20 miles and we ended up shooting them on the freeway. I shot and killed one man by the name of Min Nguyen and injured two others that were also in the car with him.
What was going through your mind in that moment that you pulled the trigger?
How dare they get in, they fight with us? Don't they know who we are? And more importantly, don't they know who I am?
And in the book, I know you have a really special relationship with your mother. How did you tell her that this is what happened, or how did she find out?
My mom never knew. I never told my mom. She first found out about it about 5 months later when the police raided our home. And, you know, they kicked down the doors. The SWAT team ran in with the flashbang grenades and everything. They did the gang raids and cuffed me up and said that they were arresting me for murder.
And what happened after that?
I was arrested. They tried me for the death penalty. It was 5 months after the crime had happened. By that time, I knew somebody had died already, so I had already got rid of the gun. I had already coached witnesses. I lied at trial, and I benefited from it. They tried me for the death penalty. The jury found me guilty of second-degree murder, and I was given a 15-year-to-life sentence.
And did you feel any remorse at that point? I feel like if I murdered someone, the guilt would just be eating me alive.
No, I'm ashamed to say no, I did not feel remorse at that point. For me, it was in my mind, I justified it that it was my life or theirs. This is what happens in the gang life. I don't, you know, like they shouldn't have told, like if they wanted to get me back, then they should get me on the streets. Why do they have to tell the police? There was never any sense of remorse.
We'll be right back. Unshaming is brought to you by you. If you love the work that Unshaming is doing and believe that it's important, you can invest in us for just a few dollars a month. Log on to patreon.com/unshaming to become a patron of the show. Your investment in us goes into higher production quality, expanding our reach so that these stories inspire as many people as possible. It also helps us produce content more frequently. Thank you so much to all of our generous Unshaming patrons so far. Once again, that's patreon.com/unshaming.
And so then you get into prison. What is that like? Going from the gang life, being on the streets, and then now understanding I may spend the rest of my life here.
Basically, California prisons at the time, they were known that nobody ever paroles from a life sentence. Nobody ever comes home.
Just explain to the listeners what parole is.
Parole is being released from prison. So yeah, with a life sentence, that means in California at the time, it meant that nobody gets to go home. If you have a life sentence, you are dying in prison.
So what was prison life like?
Coming in and with no sense of remorse, the first prison I hit was Pelican Bay, and it was known to be notorious for having the most violent gang members in the state of California. So in my mind, I just said, okay, if people here are known to be violent, the most violent gang members in the state of California, I'm going to be sure to prove why I'm the most violent gang member and why I belong just on this yard. You know, that was the mindset I took, and I think that was the mindset of a lot of us in prison. As long as we don't show weakness, then we're going to be okay. So, you know, and then on top of that, then I get involved with, you know, I mean, I'm never going home, so why do I care? I'm going to get involved with tobacco. I'm going to get involved with smuggling drugs and dealing in drugs and contraband cell phones. And I was in and the gambling rackets. So I was involved in all of that.
And there's a hierarchy to the prison system as well, correct?
Yeah, it's a self-created hierarchy. I mean, you know, rapists and child molesters at the time, anybody that came in for that type of crime, we considered them the lowest of the low. And then, you know, people that knew how to hustle, people that were involved with violence, people that had come in for gang crimes, we've considered ourselves the top of the pecking order. And you continue to drive up the pecking order by inflicting violence on others.
So I want to fast forward to the part of the book where you begin to realize that, for lack of better terms, prison does not have to suck. And you begin experiencing this awakening. How did you go from murdering someone and not feeling remorse to then having gratitude and being present and wanting to ask forgiveness for what you did?
Around the 10th, 11th year of my prison sentence, several things happened. I mean, I've always been a bookworm, so I was constantly reading throughout my prison term. And my little niece was born, and I got a picture of her from my brother. And she looked exactly like how I remembered my brother as a little kid, like a little child. So it just took me back to, where's my life going and how did I end up here? And how is it that now I'm going to die in prison? Like, how did my life end like this? Being the bookworm, I was reading all these books, and one book led me to another, and I ended up stumbling on books of the saints, particularly stories of saints that like had failed in their lives or had also done some terrible things, but yet they went on to create a legacy for themselves, and yet they went on to transform their lives and basically do good for the world. And those stories resonated with me. And it was just one day in a prison yard, I was standing by the fence, and it was early morning, and I just asked myself, like, why does prison have to be punishment? Why can't this be a place where I could remake myself, even if I'm supposed to die in here? And then I realized I could. And just that realization, you know, that small, subtle shift in thinking, it made all the difference in the world. The sun was coming up that morning, and I could feel the warmth. On the individual blades of grass, I saw the little drops of dew. And up above me in the razor wire, I heard a sparrow chirping. Sparrows had probably been chirping my whole term, and I never heard it. But that day I heard it. From that day on, like, prison did not feel like punishment. It felt like a place where I could reconnect with other human beings. I saw all these men around me now as other human beings just on their own journey. Many of them much further along than me. Some of them perhaps not even awakened yet. But that's how I began to view my days in prison as, what can I do today to learn more about myself? Like, what's the lesson that the universe is going to give me to make myself a better human being? You know, what can I do today to make myself better than I was yesterday? Then I signed up with a therapist to talk about my father's death. And it's like 25 years after he had passed away is when I began to start finally grieving him.
Mm.
Yeah. As I began grieving his death and going to therapy, then, of course, being the bookworm, I was fascinated by things on grief and loss and the healing process and the mourning process. And I noticed that men all around me were also grieving, and they had no way to process it. You know, where there's grieving the loss of a partner that has left them because they've been in prison too long, or children that have moved on, or, you know, the loss of friendships that they had, or even friends that they made at one prison and they have to transfer. And these are friends they've had for 5, 6, 7 years. And now they have to go to a new prison, have to make new friends. And there's no way to, these are all types of grief that they were experiencing. I put together a syllabus and I submitted it to the prison psychologist. The psychologist loved it. And we created our first grief and loss group at the time. And I saw firsthand, wow, here I am, finally can make a difference. And suddenly my life had such meaning and purpose. Anything and anything to really help my community. And I saw, like, okay, this is where I could leave my legacy. This is where I could start to help those around me that are in pain and in darkness. And I don't know, it gave me such a renewed sense of purpose to my life while in prison. And I knew, like, this is my little forgotten corner of the world that nobody would ever know about. But here I am, and I can still make a difference here. And that's what I was trying to do.
And the second part of the book is on the lines of what we're discussing. It's really about taking responsibility for your actions. And I noticed in the beginning of the book, you use the term gang-related murder. you made it a point to say that so people would know, well, you know, I didn't like kill my ex-girlfriend, or I wasn't a serial killer. I wasn't that kind of murderer.
Yeah.
At a certain point in the book, you say, I am in prison for the murder of another human being, but I am no longer that person. Yet my truth makes people feel uncomfortable. How did you lean into that truth? What was it like accepting that truth? And I think at that point you were over 10 years into your prison sentence.
Yeah. Owning the ugliest part of me, if I could face it, then there's really nothing to, I'm not tethered to this expectation that this person will like me. I don't need this person's approval. This is the ugliest thing that I have done. So when I could just say, I'm in prison for the murder of another human being, what else can somebody say? And that's where I realized that's where the true sense of power can come from, is just owning the ugliest parts of me. And just when I approached it that way, and then I approached my life that way in how I wanted to show up in the world, like, okay, this is who I am. This is my true, genuine self, my authentic self. I mean, even to this day, when I say it, usually they sit there and are taken back, and then they usually try to make the excuses for me, like, oh, was it gang related? And I say, well, I was in a gang. Well, were you forced to do this? And I said, no. Was it your life or theirs? I said, no. And usually people will ask those questions of me, and it's reversed, like, and they want to make the excuses for me to kind of make me not that bad of a person. But I think in owning just all the ugly aspects of myself, then I am okay with it.
I want to circle back to grief for a moment. 25 years after your dad died, you mentioned, is like when you first started to grieve that loss. What was that like for you?
Oh, painful, but so healing and so liberating. My first real cry. The psychologist had encouraged me to write a letter to my father to tell him all the things I never got to tell him. After I wrote it, though, like, I was crying throughout writing it, and I wanted to share it with her, and I brought it in to the therapist's office. And that was probably, you know, if you think about the ugliest crying session you ever seen in your life, that was me, like, snot running down my face, my nose everywhere. But I got through the letter, and that was healing. Just hear myself, those words out loud, telling my father I was sorry, and telling my father where I needed certain things from him that I didn't get. But yeah, I saw, like, how all of these identities that I associated with were all fake. And I realized at that time, moment, like, that's because I'm fake. Like, you know, I have no true sense of identity, no true substance as a person. So I went back to, you know, that young little boy that lost his father. Like, even the young little boy that used to take those road trips with his father, and looked and went back to that time, and then re-embraced myself there, and then looked to rebuild myself from that person forward.
After 22 years total in prison, years of self-reflection, self-work, and remorse, Quan Huynh sat in front of a parole board hearing in 2015 and was granted his freedom.
Once you got out of prison, how was that? How was that readjusting to society and trying to find a job and finding love and meaningful connections with people after like 22 years of being incarcerated?
I come home and I don't have my support network. I don't have my friends, and I miss them. Even like little things, like the first night I woke up, I could barely sleep. I wanted to make coffee, and I couldn't figure out how to work the coffee machine. And I was like, where's instant coffee? Like, why can't I do this? And then turning on the TV, there's hundreds of channels, and I don't know what to do to just try to find, you know, going to the grocery store for the first time and seeing those self-checkout machines, and afraid to go over there and ask somebody, how do you do this? I'm afraid I'm going to mess this up. The challenges with even just rebuilding the relationship with my family and with family members that hadn't seen me in years or decades, and them looking at me or viewing me or remembering me as one way, and then me coming home with a different perspective on life, on communicating. I began grieving my father's death 25 years after he passed away. I came home and I seen family members particular, my mom has not even begun to grieve his death yet. So some days missing my friends in prison and being unhappy out here and thinking there's something wrong with me because I'm supposed to be happy that I'm home now. There's a part of me that felt guilty. There's many more well-deserving men that are still inside. How did I get to come home, you know, when I did such worse things and knowing that some of them are going to die in there? So those were like adjusting challenges I had in the beginning and even many years after I came home. And that was a lot of the motivation for writing the book. And that's why I dedicated the book to the men I left behind.
Quan, what is giving you purpose today?
The work I do at DeFi Ventures, the nonprofit I work for, that's giving me purpose. It's a nonprofit that helps transform the lives of the currently and formerly incarcerated, to transform their lives through the journey of entrepreneurship. So helping other men and women that are coming home readjust to their new world, you know? And somebody pointed out to me the parallels of what my father's work was doing in Utah, helping new families readjust to their new country or their new world, and me doing it on a different level, but very parallel for somebody else in their readjustment journey. Giving me purpose was being able to write this book and know that I could get into the prisons and hopefully it will help spark change in someone's life. I mean, I realized like we all live in some type of prison. Writing the book and having people give me feedback on how the book has also helped them free themselves in some way is really affirming. And that's given me purpose.
I'm wondering if you could read to us the letter that you wrote to the mother of the man that you murdered.
Yeah. In 2011, I felt like this is how I can try to make amends in some small way. So I felt, you know what? I want to write a letter to the mother of the man that I killed. And the first time I wrote it, it was a really long letter. It was like 3 pages long, all these eloquent words. But to me, I go, what can I really say to the mother of the man that I killed? And I realized nothing. So I chopped it up, I cut it down, and I ended up with this letter. Dear Mrs. Julie Nguyen, I want you to know I am truly sorry for taking your son's life. I am sorry for forever tainting the way you may see the world and taking the joy out of it. I pray that in some small way, my words could provide some measure of healing for you. I want you to know that I am not the same person that committed this violent and senseless act, and I'm living a life from here on out to honor the man whom I will be forever paying my penance for. Your son, Min Nguyen.
In America, we view people who are incarcerated, people in the prison system, we don't view them as human beings. We don't view them as people with pain and hope and dreams and love and desires. If you could leave us with one thing that you want people to know about this population of people, what would that be?
I would say that every human being is worth salvaging. I know a lot of people would disagree with that, but I would say that there are some amazing, beautiful souls that are incarcerated. I think any human being has the capacity to change at any given moment in their life. I saw it happen all around me, and I would have to say, like, in some small way, I was able to change my view set. One of my favorite quotes was from a saint, was Saint Francis of Assisi, who says, I have been all things unholy. If God can work through me, surely he can work through anyone. And I truly believe those words.
Well, thank you so much, Quan.
You're welcome.
I'm Jorgen Salvis, and you've been listening to Unshaming. For more information about anyone featured on the show, follow us on Instagram at Unshaming or visit unshamingpodcast.com. If you liked this episode, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. If you have questions or want to tell us what you're unshaming, DM us on Instagram or email us at unshamingpodcast@gmail.com. Special thanks to Mirzi for generously providing her original music. You can find her wherever you stream. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next time.